Now we're going to pass the magic bullet today.
That's the way I envision it. But I don't know if we move on to the
I found the article I was looking for about a year ago on health care. Healthcare, how much can we afford?
All right, fine.
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Fantastic. Right, no.
If comparing it to GDP
growth,
absolutely. It's a lovely and ill.
I figured that, but I think 2070, even if healthcare has been there enough, that's a great
one. That's a good one.
We'd still be up to 170. We still have more money to spend on healthcare. Healthcare is starting at a smaller height.
It's growing.
Yeah. All, which means this is right now. I think one per year with Wyoming, like 170 in the healthcare increase. That's a big trip.
Cut me short on that.
But I might have a good knee too.
That's right.
Okay, how are you doing?
What are we doing? Well, we don't have enough people. It would be really kind of funny to move the boat and have it moved in the house already before they got here.
Always.
Yeah.
I hear we're going to Alexandria again. Yeah.
Hope it's not woken you within 30 seconds of losing your bell. To order. Today we are dealing with two bills that I believe deal with sort of the tax compliant issue for health savings accounts, and I understand that Representative Knobloch has other comments as well. I think I would like to offer an opportunity, and then we'll get into the substance of the presentations. Representative Knobloch, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Chairman Bradley and members. Members, I'm afraid I can't stay the whole hour or even all that long, but I have Representative Wilkin, who has essentially the same bill as the bill I have on basically having state conformity to what the federal government has done in regard to the tax treatment of health savings accounts. Members, I think this is really an important bill. We need to adopt state conformity to what the federal government has done. If you look at what's happening in the health care area, I think somehow we have to set up a system where people have a little bit more stake in what the cost of their health care is, where they have some incentive to shop around, where they have some incentive to look at what the costs are when they're purchasing that health care. And experience so far with health savings account has shown that this is a really promising way to hold down health care costs while still delivering care. I think we need to provide care for people and provide those opportunities, but I think this is a cost-effective way to deliver care, and I certainly would urge your support of this important initiative.
Thank you, Representative Nadler. I think the way we'll handle this, the way we'll handle this is that we'll move on House File 9 and operate the discussion, and then we'll add a motion because I think both bills need to move. Now, I'll take the advice of the authors. I know that it needs to end up in taxes. There's some question about whether or not you want it to have. So, Representative Wilkin, you want to start us with a motion? Thank you, Representative Nadler.
Thank you, Mr. Bradley. Let me just say, members, the reason we have sort of two bills, Representative Wilkin and I think each independently developed this bill idea a couple of years ago. We each independently introduced the bills at the same time, and we had a joint hearing on this 2 years ago, and that's why we're here with separate bills today. But I appreciate your indulgence, and thank you. I'll turn it over to the capable Representative Wilkin.
I thought maybe you'd use the line of something like great minds travel in same lines or something like that.
I thought I'd save that for the kid.
Thank you, Representative Nadler. Representative Wilkin, would you like to make your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's always good to have the Chairman of the Ways and Means supporting similar bills. I've talked to the Chair of the Commerce Committee, and he'd like to see the bills over in Commerce, so I'd move House File 9 and...
I think we'll move just one because I think it would be, for the record, be better we have. When we complete, and if we have approval from the committee, then it'll be fairly simple for us to move House File 135 also.
Okay.
I think for now we'll move House File.
Can you advance the Wilkin bill and kill the Knobloch bill?
Yeah,
he's
gone.
Remember, he's the chair of Ways and Means. Representative Wilkin,
House File 9 with recommendation to pass and be re-referred to the Commerce Committee.
Representative Wilkin moves that House File 9 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Wilkin, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, in your packets you should have a memo from me that I provided. It's kind of a data sheet to introduce you to the issues at hand here, and we'll have a presentation that probably goes into more detail and can answer more questions than I ever could. But basically what health savings accounts do is it provides for a high deductible plan to be purchased by the owner, and that sits on top of a savings account. And the savings account takes in deposits on a tax-free basis and makes distributions on a tax-free basis. Accumulation in the account accumulates on a tax-free basis also, and it can be put into various investments so that it grows over time. The money in the account can be used for what's called qualified medical expenses, and in your packets you should have a two-sheet summary from a web page from American Fidelity Assurance that was given to me that kind of summarizes some of these qualifying medical expenses. Benefits of this program is it's really a very powerful tool to help contain healthcare costs.
Mr. Chairman, pardon me. Representative Wilkin, you made reference to a sheet from a company that shows the list of qualified expenses. I'm not seeing that.
Is that not in there?
What are we referring to? I do have something in my packet that says memo from State Representative Tim Wilkin. Is that one you're talking about?
There's a memo from me, and then there's also, maybe it didn't get in there yet, but there's, Representative Huntley has it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I do have that.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Here.
Okay. Basically, when the consumer has the incentive to accumulate money in the account, because it stays with the individual, unlike some prior products that they didn't get to accumulate year to year, this is a very powerful tool to accumulate for future medical expenses, and the consumer, it's coming out of their hide if they're making the first dollar expenditures. So they have incentive to be cost conscious and to be careful in their healthcare consuming. It accumulates on a tax-free basis. It's portable. It can go from one employer to another. You take it with you. You own it. Your employer does not. So if you become unemployed, you have something where you can pay your medical expenses
even if you don't have coverage currently, you have, hopefully you've built up a pot of money where you can pay your medical expenses out of, or you can pay your COBRA, your continuing benefit out, your extension from your prior employer, and you can take that into your next employer. It also benefits you in retirement. You can use it for your retiree health care, for Medicare expenses and prescription drugs. It is a competitiveness issue for Minnesota. Other states are conforming to this. 31 states have conformed. There's 9 states that don't need to conform because they don't tax income. So there's only 11 states that are including Minnesota that have not conformed to the federal language. One of those is Wisconsin. I'd sure like to beat them to the punch on something, so we're a little more competitive in one area than them. It also helps enormously with the uninsured. The data that's coming out from the private companies that are offering these show that at least a third of the participants were previously uninsured. And that's, it's primarily probably because it's a lower cost alternative for them and they're currently being priced out of the market. Since they're using a high deductible plan, they can that itself holds down costs rather than having the first dollar coverage, and just engaging the consumer so that they ask their providers about cost, so that they're asking about the absolute necessity of treatment, and so that they go out and comparison shop. You know, there's also quality issues too, but price will become an issue, and more providers will feel the pressure not to just set the price at whatever they can get because the third-party payers are paying everything. Federal tax conformity will allow Minnesotans to take full advantage of these accounts, which they can't now. They don't get the full benefit that you get in 40 other states. And the final item you'll see on the data sheet is when I invest in mutual funds, I look really closely at the fees they charge, because small differences, minute differences in fees over the years can really change the way your account accumulates, your 401ks and such that are in mutual funds. Well, the same thing goes for health savings accounts. When there's a tax benefit, if you're missing that even small increment of a state tax benefit, that's going to have a major impact on how your money accumulates in the account over the years until you reach retirement. And that leads me to point out another item that's in your packets that kind of shows that. You've all seen it for your 401k probably, but this shows the accumulation benefits and the compounding benefits over the years that you can take into retirement. That's all I have right now. I know we have some testifiers. Mr. Freeby has a presentation.
Mr. Morgan, just to make very sure, the language of your bill is a tax conformity. But can you just explain the timings of it? Because I believe your suggestion becomes effective for tax years beginning after December 31st. But the paragraph at the beginning talks about effective at the time they became effective for federal purposes. What's the timing? How does the timing work?
The way it's written now is that it's effective when the federal law went into effect, which would be January 1st, I believe, of 2004. So there's some retroactivity built into here. This is an issue that the tax committee is going to have to deal with based on their target, whether they can do retroactivity or whether it's going to have to be January 1st of 2005 or when signed into law. It's strictly a dollars argument at that point.
Thank you. Maybe if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah. Good morning. My name is Jim Preeby. I am with a local third-party administrator here in St. Paul. We administer primarily self-funded medical plans for Minnesota employers. We do also work with smaller employers on consulting basis and work with them on plan design and trying to find insurance products for their employees and also individuals. Today I'm going to just go over briefly expand on Representative Wilkins' comments in a little more detail on the HSAs and provide some education and background for you on that, and also talk to you a little bit about some of the things we're seeing from some employers and individuals out there that are choosing the HSA models. I want to start out with, there was a recent Fidelity study that was done in that study they reported that if someone were to retire today at age 65, a couple would need approximately $175,000 in savings to fund out-of-pocket medical expenses during retirement age. We believe HSAs will be that tool to allow people to save for medical expenses after retirement and also before retirement. HSAs are a tax-favored IRA type account that individuals covered by a high-deductible health plan can establish to pay for certain medical expenses under IRS Code Section 213D if they do not have an impermissible non-high-deductible health plan coverage. And that this is something that employees own. They take with them from employer to employer. They own this for the remainder of their life and then into retirement. A little bit of background, it was created by the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, created new IRS Code 223 as the primary section governing HSAs. From a tax break standpoint, an HSA can benefit anyone who currently pays taxes. If an HSA is contributed to by an individual without an employer involvement, then the individual gets an above-the-line tax deduction for the amounts contributed that do not exceed statutory limits. Amounts in the HSA build up on a tax-free basis. And distributions for qualified medical expenses are not taxed also when they take them out. If an employer contributes towards an HSA or offers an HSA through a cafeteria plan, the employer gets a deduction for the amounts contributed that do not exceed statutory limits. An employer contributes and employee pre-tax salary reductions are excluded from employees' taxable income. And the amounts in the HSAs again build up tax-free and distributions are tax-free for qualified medical expenses. Definition of a high deductible health plan. There is a federal statutory guidelines around a definition of a high deductible health plan. It's basically a comprehensive health plan with an annual deductible of at least $1,000 for self-only coverage, $2,000 for family coverage. Embedded deductibles must not be less than $2,000. The plan may be insured or self-insured, may provide preventative care under the deductible. So what that means is that you can still run preventative care benefits at 100%, not subject to the deductible. And out-of-pocket maximums cannot exceed $5,100 for self-only, $10,200 for family coverage. Those amounts are adjusted annually by the federal government for inflation and will keep moving up based on CPI and different indexes.
Excuse me, Mr. Friedman, if I may take you back just a little bit to the distribution. You said something that I am familiar with, that distribution for qualified medical expenses are not taxed. In a discussion last night, we were told that 65 and older, there's a different standard for distributions. And matter of fact, as it was explained, that you could use it for anything, which was a little bit of a surprise to me. Do you have some insight on the 65 or older?
Yeah, 65 or older, you still can't pull it out for anything. You can't pull it out and buy a vacation home, those type of things without tax penalties. But it does open up, and I'll get into it a little bit further. It does get into Medicare premiums and different types of premiums that you can use that for when you get into retirement.
It's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that you can pull it out, but you then pay income tax. You don't pay the 10% penalty.
Yeah.
That you would pay earlier.
Yeah, over 65 it would be
your money.
Yeah, yep. Representative. Yeah, over 65 would be taxed as income for non-qualified medical expenses.
Okay.
If you pull it out before 65, there is a 10% penalty for pulling it out for non-qualified.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Again, the high deductible health plan we talked about. The contributions to an HSA, the maximum annual HSA contribution is the lesser of 100% of the annual deductible under the high deductible health plan or indexed amount by the federal government. 2005 indexed amounts are $26.50 for self-only coverage, $52.50 for family coverage. There is a special rule for married individuals where it's taking a combination into play. And there are catch-up contributions for 55 and older. $600 this year, that's supposed to go up to $1,000 and cap at $1,000 over the course of the next few years. Contributions to an HSA for a given taxable year can be made at once or in any number of installments. So a taxpayer could pay, come to the end of a tax year and decide they need to fund their HSA account, and they could fund the entire amount in one lump sum, or they can do it in individual equal amounts through an employer payroll deduction amount throughout the course of the year. Contributions must be made no later than due date for the employee's federal income tax return without extensions. Contributions can be made by an employee, an employer, or both. That's important to know. And excess contributions are subject to a 6% excise tax. So you can contribute over the indexed amount, however, you're subject to a 6% tax.
Just to be on that, and you may get into this, but if you either contribute more or you built up a balance, and you have some sort of a higher cost incident that occurs, mm-hmm. Are you obliged to use that account first before anything else kicks in?
No, it's actually your discretion when you want to use that account. If you do have a balance built up in that account and you had a $1,000 expense and you wanted to pay for that out of your own pocket and not take money out of your HSA account because it's in a growth fund and you might be earning interest on that and you don't want to take it out, you don't have to use that HSA account for every medical expense. It's your discretion when you want to use it, when you want to pull it out. There's a lot of flexibility in how you use those dollars.
We have another question. Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the contributions to the deductible, the employee can make it, the employer can make it. Mm-hmm. They can make them together. Now, it's my understanding a third party can also make contributions to this. Number one, is that correct?
Not that I'm aware of, that a third party can make contributions. I haven't seen any models that allow for any third party contributions. The only models that exist that we've seen are with employers, employees, or a combination of both.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a couple quick questions. First of all, do you have to be employed to make contributions into these accounts?
Mr. Preeby.
No, you don't have to be employed. I'm going to talk a little bit at the end about a couple of case studies that we have of individuals who are self-employed, non-employed, that have these accounts that now have the ability to get insurance because of what Representative Wilkins had talked about, that now the carriers are offering high-deductible health plans which have lower premium costs associated with them, so it's allowing more individuals to actually purchase insurance. Whether they establish an HSA account is their choice after that. But there are now plans available that are at a lower cost. So I'll talk a little bit about how those work.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, one more quick one. In regards to cost versus charges and paying for your care out of your account, do you pay costs or charges?
You pay after your claim has gone through your insured. If there's discounts that apply, those type of things, then you pay after it's gone through your insurance policy, then you pay the provider based on any discounted amounts for those things that would exist.
Mr. Wilkins, do you have a...
Yeah, that would be the Huntley Amendment from last year, if you recall. Because we're inadvertently going to wipe that out, and Representative Huntley pointed out that we should preserve that so that they're buying with the HSA dollars at the lower dollar amount, the discounted value that the insurance company pays for.
Yeah, I think it is a protection of you. I guess you'll get back to that. Okay, please proceed.
Again, continuing with the distributions, again, those distributions are for qualified expenses under IRS Code Section 213D and for any account beneficiary, spouse, or IRS Code 152 eligible dependents. There is a no double dipping rule, so that means you can't, if an insurance plan pays for an expense, you also can't have that expense reimbursed out of your HSA account and be eligible. There are qualified insurance expenses that can be paid from an HSA. If an individual were to lose employment and had an established account, they could use those dollars in that account to pay for COBRA continuation coverage. Health insurance premiums while receiving unemployment compensation, long-term insurance premiums. Individuals over 65 can use those distributions for health insurance other than Medicare supplement policy. They can use it for the Medicare premium itself, premiums for individual health insurance policies, again, excluding the Medigap policies, and retiree medical premiums under an employer plan could be used as well.
Mr. Peter, if I may, on the long-term care insurance, if I, because there's some comparisons a person could make to the pre-tax accounts that you currently set up, but I think in the pre-tax accounts, I don't know that long-term care insurance is a eligible for deduction. Am I correct in that?
That's correct, Chairman.
So that does expand some eligibility.
Yes.
And I think sort of a corollary to that in terms of question is that sort of the question of what medical expenses, is it clearly defined yet in the HSA rules as to what medical expenses are eligible under the HSA?
Yes. Section 213 of the IRS code has been around for quite a long time and has really governed your flexible spending plans eligibility. So they're just mirroring those plans. So expenses like dental care would be covered under this. So individuals who may not have dental coverage offered to them could now use HSA dollars for reimbursements in dental care, vision care. A lot of health plans might not cover vision care as far as glasses or contacts. Those type of expenses are now eligible under an HSA as well. So it's the entire 213D expense.
And maybe then, I don't remember this one, are long-term care insurance expenses eligible under the IRS code?
No, they're not under a Section 125 plan. They're not a pre-tax.
So that is a kind of a distinct extension or expansion under the HSAs then?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Adler.
We were talking taxes. I'm just, on the, when you, this, what your contributions amount, whatever the limit would be in a year, is that on Schedule A, or is it on the front page of the 1040, or is it part of the floor that we have to, in the deduction part?
Mr. Peavy.
Since I'm not a tax expert, I can't really say where exactly it falls. I deal more in structuring with these, and I'm not a tax expert when it comes to filing taxes and those type of things. I understand where the deductions and those things occur, but from an individual standpoint, if you're not part of an employer-sponsored plan where it's coming off of a pre-tax, it's an above-the-line deduction on your taxes. So you're paying at least dollars, obviously, on an after-tax basis and taking deduction on your individual tax.
I think we might get some staff help in that, Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, it's what's called an above-the-line deduction. So in terms of the standard IRS 1040 form, it's in the front.
Oh.
You know, in the section down near the bottom where the
that's where you want
IRA deductions are.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I just want to talk a little bit about some real-life examples that we've been seeing here in the state of Minnesota, because Minnesotans are electing to go this route with HSAs. And we're seeing quite a few employers and individuals actually taking advantage of this. I had recently worked with a small employer of four employees who are home health care workers, employees, low wage earning employees averaging $10 to $12 an hour. We looked at their current increase in insurance premium under a fully insured plan, low deductible plan, and the increase was pretty significant for each individual. We talked with the employer and we talked with each individual and asked them if they would trade, if they'd be willing to trade risk off and pay less in premium contributions and put money aside into a HSA account that can grow and they can use it to cover that deductible gap over the future years. The employees were very excited about being able to take advantage of something like that. The individuals in this group understand the risk trade-off. They understand going to a high deductible, they're going to pay less premiums and they're going to have more dollars available to put into an HSA account and put into money market funds and those type of things that are going to allow them to have expenses grow. In this case, we actually, from an employer standpoint, had their increase neutral to what they were paying today. So we actually were able to have the employer fund 100% underneath the deductible for each employee this year, and then they move into a 100% plan. So the employees actually this year, by establishing an HSA plan with a high deductible health plan, actually have a better health plan than they had last year under a low deductible health plan, and they also now have this account that's going to grow and travel with them if they were to leave employment. They're excited about that. Another small employer that we were working with, again, high to medium wage and low wage income workers, employer of about 13 employees, annual premium of about $97,000 with a fully insured carrier in town. We looked at a high deductible health plan and put that in place with them, and the premium came back about $62,000 annually for that same group. Again, they were able to fund 100% difference, revenue neutral to what their insurance premiums were today, and establish a full account and have a better insurance plan this year going into it. And over the course of the year, the employer is going to fund 50% down to 25%, do some matching things back into the HSA contribution so that employees are allowed to grow those counts and take those counts with them. So they're establishing as employees. There's a myth that these only work for people who have extra income or for the rich and not for folks who can't afford to put money aside, and that's not true because people who are at that lower wage, they understand the economics of this stuff. They understand that if they have the ability to go purchase premium, and it's an individual family I worked with, they looked at it and said, we're pretty healthy. We don't have a lot of extra income to buy insurance. They went out and got an individual family quote at one of the local carriers. It came back about $750 a month. We looked at it and we got a high deductible quote for them that came back at about $450 a month. They're a healthy family. They understand the risk that if they're going to trade off and they're going to take that difference in what they would have had to pay that premium and put it away in a HSA account and let it grow tax-free, and eventually they're going to cover that gap and have no out-of-pocket expenses if it's truly it goes along. If they do have a catastrophic claim, their risk and their out-of-pocket expense is no more than what it would have been today. So they're trading off those dollars. Instead of giving up that premium and trying to afford that premium each month, they're having discretion on where they put that and letting it grow. So it truly is a tool for everybody to use. It's not just for the folks who are doctors, lawyers, and high wage earning professions. The actual people who are in blue collar jobs and things actually get these type of models a lot better than actually the white collar workers do, and it does provide some equitable balance in the workforce because folks who are contributing premiums that are maybe making $100,000 and they're contributing $100 towards the premium cost a month versus someone making $20,000 a year and contributing $100 a month to a premium is quite different when you actually get into the equitableness of a health plan. So it kind of makes things more equitable, and people understand this and are willing to give those trade-offs for risk. Is there any other questions?
Just a couple of observations. First of all, to come back, I think Representative Wilkin mentioned something that I think is very, very important in this, and I've seen this in several examples, that a high percentage, I believe you used about a third, Representative Wilkin, of the people that have come on to HSAs were previously uninsured. So first of all, is that the kind of ballpark we're seeing? Are we seeing evidence of people that might not otherwise be insured?
Yeah, Chairman, I've been looking for stats over the last couple of days when I was asked to come, and I have been looking for stats on how many people actually have changed. And I haven't been able to find anything, but I have talked to individuals at carriers and individuals out, and there are a lot of individuals who previously were not insured who are buying insurance now, because what has happened in the marketplace is that the carriers have reacted to this, because in the market individuals are seeking HSA plans, and so the carriers are now offering high deductible options more so than what they may have before in the past. So now there is a high deductible option for individuals to go out and purchase, where before they might not have had that option to find a high deductible insurance plan. So it's allowing individuals, again, that were maybe not able to afford a low deductible plan to be able to get in and get some insurance.
Thank you. And then one other question, and I know we have some other people with questions, but the reason the bill is here at its heart is because of health care costs. I happen to be one of the believers that as we get consumers better engaged in the best value of health care, that they'll be smarter, more powerful, and sometimes kind of cranky buyers, which is okay by me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know it's a little early. Is there any evidence in terms of sort of the aggregate where, for example, we do have some models. I mean, you know of Umstead Medical Center, mm-hmm. where they've got 1,000 employees who are using HRA, but in many respects very similar. So okay. We're actually seeing some evidence of sort of any behavioral changes or anything that would have a bearing on overall health care cost.
Yeah, actually our organization, again, we administer self-funded medical plans, and we instituted HRA models back when they first came out. So we have a large majority of employers that are on HRA models. We've actually seen those plans in our utilization, and we measure this by claim volume, actual claim utilization dropping pretty significantly by about 20% across those plans that have those HRA models. We're contributing it back to the fact that individuals have these savings accounts. They're being wiser consumers. They're understanding the questions to ask. We don't ask employees to go out and shop for major services. If someone's having a heart attack, we don't want them to shop around and find out where should I go and who's going to be the cheapest emergency room right now. What they should shop for is office visits, those kind of things where they bring kids in for ear infections and those kind of things. And there's a lot of great stories about actually individuals doing those kind of things. In town, some of you might be familiar with the Minute Clinic concept, and we have those clinics are now in network for a lot of the networks here in town. And individuals are utilizing them because it only costs $44 to go there to have a strep throat test or an ear infection test or pink eye test versus going to one of the clinics where it costs $120 or $130. People get the economics of this stuff really quick, and they understand where the dollars are coming from and want to establish those accounts.
Thank you. Representative Abel, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. A couple of questions. And I appreciate the longitudinal stuff you're talking about from the same group and some follow-up, as that's you said in your example about reduced 20% fewer claims and so on. That was the longitudinal. That's great. As people apply for these, and there's small, I'm especially interested in small employers, trying to find ways to drive them into offering care and take some pressure off the public market. That's my background on these questions. Do you notice as you interview a small employer, you know, if there's one person gets sick in a small employer group, that the whole group gets just whacked, and it's just a challenge for that group. Do you find that a group that's had a history of, you know, one or two people having high use still wanting to adopt this plan? And are those people that are the high users interested in this plan too?
Yes, we do see that, because how it works is that we trade off from an out-of-pocket standpoint. So if you're designing plans correctly, you're looking at out-of-pockets. In a low-deductible plan, there still is an out-of-pocket amount that an individual is paying. In a high-deductible plan, there still is an out-of-pocket max that an individual is paying. You can design a lot of these plans and pick plans and choose plans so that the out-of-pockets line up today. It's how dollars flow through from a premium standpoint, which makes a difference. So in a catastrophic sense or high users, you try to design the plan so that those folks are paying no more out-of-pocket than they're paying today. The individuals who are not using the plan are able to contribute and save, so that you balance those out. And it's really just being a wise consumer as an employer or a purchaser of health care for employees to make sure you're picking the right plans around your out-of-pockets today so you don't upset that balance.
Second question. And maybe beyond the scope of this meeting today, maybe we should just chat in private, but I'm interested in some of the actual model plans that you've set up for groups of five. I think a small group of 20 has some bodies in it, but these twos and fives and the small insurance companies and the people that have clerical staffs that are not your high salary jobs, if there's a way we can drive some of those folks to make it easier for them to take advantage of this or other options, I'm really interested in that.
Well, I can answer that. In the state, it's difficult because if you're an employer and have under 50 covered lives, really it's kind of dictated on what coverages you're going to have. And from carrier to carrier within the state, there's not a lot of options. You know, there's three or four main options in the state that you can go to. So there's not a lot of variety between those. So you're pretty, from a plan design standpoint, in small employers, they're pretty limited at how they can pick and choose those plan designs. There are a variety of different plan designs that the carriers offer. But again, it's going to be more of a pecan product that a carrier is offering, and the employer's not going to have a lot of say in designing it, per se.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman.
Can
I get back to just before Representative Huntley asks his next question? I got some data that I think you had asked about previously. The number of uninsured who are utilizing these, according to American Health Insurance Plans, their Center for Policy and Research. Last fall, their data showed that 30% of the policies were purchased by individuals who did not previously have coverage. Another source that I found, eHealth Insurance, which is an internet-based broker, said that 30% were previously uninsured. And as far as the actual effectiveness of lowering utilization, I think you have this in your packet from Blue Cross. Their consumer-directed plans showed fewer trips to the doctor and emergency room visits, less than members of other commercial plans, and increased use of preventive services and generic drugs, all cost savings features.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Preeby or Preeb?
Yeah, Preeby.
Okay, a couple of questions. One, do you have any employers that offer their employees a choice of an HSA and regular insurance, or are they all locked into one or the other?
Mr. Preeby.
Currently, all of our employer groups that we do administration for are locked into one or the other. They move the entire group to one model. Larger employers are offering choices between a standard health plan and the high deductible models. There's still a lot of work being done to make sure that from a premium contribution standpoint that there's balance in where people want to go in making those contributions equitable, so that if someone chooses high deductible health plan, it's worth the premium contributions. And in some plans, we haven't seen the difference great enough for individuals to want to move, not big enough incentive for individuals to want to move to that. So larger employers are offering a choice. Smaller employers, typically it doesn't make sense to offer a choice from an economic standpoint, and so they usually just offer one option. You might have a smaller employer who may offer two high deductible options but still would have a savings account option in it, one with a lower deductible and a higher deductible option. And that's the nice part about these plans. Even as we've seen some of the groups who have adopted these type of models over a few years, you have individuals who save up balances, and an employer can go out or an individual can go out and buy an even a higher deductible health plan and save more in premium because they've saved X number of dollars in their savings accounts, and they cover that gap between whatever deductible or out-of-pocket they have in a savings account and save more premium dollars and put more money aside.
Representative Huntley?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Mr. Preeb, the next question is, of the plans you've sold, or whatever the word is for that, what is the maximum out-of-pocket? I have two concerns. One is that you're going to, healthy people will get into these accounts and leave the sick ones in regular accounts. And the second is if the out-of-pocket deductibles are too high, then you also discriminate against sick compared to healthy people. So what? And I know that the law is maximum deductibles are like $5,000 for individuals, $10,000. Are you selling any that are that large?
I haven't seen anybody buy any that large. There might be some individuals out there. I haven't seen any employers in my experience purchasing those. Typically, we're seeing most employers go to a $1,200, $1,500, max maybe $2,000 type self-only coverage deductible. A lot of those type of plans, from a carrier standpoint, you can get options where it's 100% coverage on the backside after the deductible is satisfied. So the maximum out-of-pocket is going to be that range from $1,200 to $2,000. You can also buy them with 80% coverage on the backside for smaller employers. Large employers have that are self-funded can obviously design their own plans, but we still haven't seen any that are going this high as well. Most of the larger employers are staying in that 2,000 self-only type.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I really like the Olmsted Clinic one, but they're locked in at a relatively small out-of-pocket, you know, $1,000, $2,000 for a family.
Yeah, I think,
and that's reasonable. I think going, if it was $10,000 out of pocket, and you happen to have a chronic illness, you're gonna every year be paying that.
Yeah, Ms. Pippen.
Representative Huntley, I think where those larger maximums will come into play is in future years, where you have individuals over the course of 3, 5, 10 years who have built up a substantial savings in their HSA account. And there could be significant premium savings to go to a plan that has a $10,000 out-of-pocket max, and they do have the money already built up in a savings account to get there. So you could see in future designs employers or individuals going to seek those type of plans because, again, individuals understand the risk and reward side of this from a premium contribution standpoint, and if someone has a bucket of money built up, they might be willing to take more risk and pay less premium, again, to fund more into a savings account. So I think in future years, as account balances are established for certain people, they might look at those options.
Thank you. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Preeb, I want to follow up with where Representative Huntley was going. We're talking about healthy people and then individuals with chronic illnesses, and there's a whole bunch of people in the middle. And technically, I have a chronic illness. However, I consider myself a very healthy individual. I have asthma, and the amount of out-of-pocket expenses just on my allergy and asthma medications, although my copayment is quite low, I'm very blessed to have good insurance. Where would I fall at if I was in a small employer coverage and versus a large coverage? I would just assume if I was in a large coverage and they were offering the two plans, I automatically would have to go back and stay with the standard. I'm not seeing how this would benefit an individual like myself.
Mr. Pitty?
Again, from an individual standpoint, you would you would look at the economics of it. You're trading dollars from a premium contribution standpoint to put into a savings account for growth. And you're trading that risk for if something were to happen to you again. And that's where I get back to the importance of looking at, from an employer's standpoint, where their current out-of-pocket maximums are for individuals today. So you try to design and create a plan or choose a plan for your employees where their out-of-pocket maximums are no more than what they're paying today. So if you ended up in a situation where your out-of-pocket maximum is $1,200 today, you try to find a plan that meets that $1,200 out-of-pocket maximum tomorrow, but also allows for you to establish a savings account on some level underneath that. So the goal of it is to try to find that, is to focus around the out-of-pocket maximum, not so much the deductible levels, but the out-of-pocket maximums, so that individuals healthy or have chronic illnesses and are large users of the plan are not paying any more out-of-pocket expense than today, but have a tool to save some dollars along with that.
Mr. Chair.
Jim Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's just say my current premium was $100 a month, so $1,200 a year. Mm. I just added up the amount that I paid for my copayment for prescriptions last year, which was more than $600. Doesn't include my doctor visits for my allergist or even my annual physical exam. So we're still talking about $2,000, not including doctor visits. I'm still trying, and not even including my son on this, and with him having sleep apnea, I'm still trying to figure out, you know, that person that falls in the middle, because it would be difficult for me to have a cost savings every single year. I would either be at zero or having to pay in under this current plan. And there's more individuals like me than that are, you know, just healthy or severely chronic. It's this middle group in making sure that, you know, if you're under 40,000, not even under 20,000, under 40,000, where do you fall in?
Again, you're going to look at your I know, and not knowing your plan and what your current out of pocket would be. If you're paying $2,000 today out of pocket expense, there's health plans out there that will get you at $2,000 deductible, 100% coverage on the backside. So again, your out-of-pocket max is $2,000 in that plan. If you don't use it all, and the other side of that, the other benefit of that is your premium contribution should be less because the premium to buy that $2,000 deductible plan is going to be less. So that $100 you're paying in hopefully is reduced to $80 or $75, so you have some savings there as well, and then you're able to establish a savings account to build up dollars. If you are a chronic user of the plan and a high user of the plan, you're right. You might use that HSA dollars every year, and depending on where you're at, but you're going to be no worse off than you were today from an out-of-pocket standpoint. And it's going to help curtail future increases from an employer standpoint because the premiums are buying a higher deductible health plan, which ultimately the premium is less expensive.
Mr. Chair, just real quick.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I see the benefit for the employer. I see the benefit for the overall business community, whether it's for-profit or non-profit. I'm just trying to figure out as a consumer that is going to be a chronic user of medical benefits for the rest of my life unless I move to the southeast. Or southwest, excuse me. As long as I'm in Minnesota, I'm going to be a chronic user of prescription drugs, and I use generic.
Yeah. Let me just a couple of things. I mean, I think Mr. Friedman is right, as I understand it. If you're designed properly, you're no worse off than what you are in a kind of a current plan. I mean, assuming you don't have an old-fashioned HMO first dollar or those kinds of things, which are generally being priced out of the market anyway. Nobody can get those anymore. But the other thing is, if you do it right, there's a couple of forces. One force, even in chronic conditions, we know that for many chronic conditions, we're not getting the right care. The right things are not necessarily being done. And sometimes it's the medical world and sometimes it's the behavior of the consumer. This is a case where if you do it right and you handle your chronic condition right, and if there are some savings you can make by doing it right, either short or longer term, you can benefit financially. Not maybe for, it doesn't work for every person, but at least it's a possibility. And the other is, if I heard you right, you are getting some unique tax advantages out of this where that's not available to you in the other models. So you might be able to make it work for you from a tax point of view, and that's why I asked you the question about, do you have to use your HSA account or could you be paying for it separately? You might be thinking, well, you know what, I might be better off leaving some of this in the HSA account paying some of it separately and so forth. I mean, it seems like even for the chronic conditions, and I'm not saying that every one of these are going to work, but it might open some options that are a little bit unique and to the advantage. At worst case, however, you're no worse off and properly designed than you would be under whatever plan you have today.
Correct.
Did I put it in the right context?
Yes, you did, Chairman.
I'm getting closer and closer on this.
You're going to have this down soon.
What's the new trend?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Preeby, the world I live in is full of a lot of self-employed people, including farmers and small business owners. And this fall I got a call from one of those farmers. They didn't qualify for Minnesota Care because you can't add back your depreciation schedule. And the best they could afford was a $5,000 deductible and an 80-20. So they had a baby. Cost $10,000, the baby did. So that's $5,000 plus another $1,000. So that's a $6,000 bill. The baby got sick. And the clinic refused to see them because they owed money. And they had to pay 10% a month in order to be able to go to the clinic. So in other words, they had no health care. So that might be part of the reason that some of this usage is being lowered, is because in reality, I have three cases like this where they were not allowed to go to the clinic as long as they had a bill. So how do we fix that? I mean, you said that most of them aren't $1,000 or $2,000, but in order to support any kind of insurance at all, they had to go to a $5,000 deductible and an 80-20 after the $5,000. And your baby is sick, and you can't even go to the clinic. And everybody thinks they're not going to get sick. But this is a reality, and I have three stories like that.
Mr. Pinky?
We can't control how the clinics work. I know there was just a recent story of some collection issues with one of the systems here. That's a fundamental difference than insurance. I'm working with a group in southern Minnesota that is working to get farmers B1s, trying to create a pool of risk for those. And in talking to a lot of the farmers and the farm families and those, they inherently understand risk. And they're willing to actually, more of them that we're talking to are more willing to take higher risk opportunities for these higher deductible plans and the opportunity to save premiums and put money away into a savings account than look for those first dollar coverages and pay the higher premiums. It gets back to that whole use it or lose it concept. If you were offered an opportunity to pay $1,000 or less a year and at the end of the day have no more risk but save that $1,000, which direction would you go? It's an insurance issue because there's certain rules around the risk category around farm families and the carriers and those type of things that we can get into a whole nother issue and debate over of is why are they inherently risk rated at a higher risk from an insurance standpoint, and so that they can only qualify for a $5,000 deductible health plan and an 80-20% coverage on the backside. And far as the clinic not accepting that to see them because they haven't paid is not an insurance issue. It's a matter of the clinic having to set their policies and how they're going to bill and do those things, and also from a rating standpoint and a risk standpoint in the insurance world of taking on that risk. I would think if you would talk to that family, if they have the ability to trade off dollars and still take that ability to take that $5,000 deductible and take the money they might save in premiums and set aside it in a savings account so that in the future, if they ever did have these kind of catastrophic expenses, that they'd have some dollars to rely back onto.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and I would also say, I think the situations you're talking about, Lieutenant Tremble, are genuine. I don't think any of us ought to paint the picture that HSAs are the panacea to solve everything. I mean, for a family that can't afford insurance, period, just repackaging it's not necessarily going to solve that.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. And that's exactly what I'm saying. They didn't have a $5,000 deductible because of a risk. They didn't have any money. They don't have any money, and that's generally... There isn't a lot of disposable income out there in a farm family or in a small business. So putting those kinds of dollars even in a savings account it's in some cases, you put food on the table or you pay your electric bill. It putting $5,000 in a, if you had that kind of disposable income, you would have chosen a lower deductible. This is real life out there. And I'm not saying that these accounts aren't good for some. But when you can't take your child to the doctor because it's not total, the bill is not totally paid, that's a problem. And it's not because it's a high-risk family. It's literally, this is all they could afford. And so all of the reasons you give about saving money, that just, I mean, those are the kinds of things the clinic said to me when I called them. Well, they shouldn't have had such a high deductible. They should have, because they, you know, they didn't have, well, they didn't have the money. And it was, and I think we have to really look at that and make sure that whoever's selling the insurance, I realize it's not, that they really look at that as, you know, this is all you can afford, you know, so we'll do a 5,080-20. But there's a lot of people out there like that. And so maybe more people are insured, but in reality, the clinic told me to tell them to go to the emergency room, which, again, was another calendar year, so it's another 5,000 deductible. So it's actually increasing costs, healthcare costs, because it's uncompensated care at some point. But...
Can I suggest, Representative Fram, I mean, I'm not meaning to deny the issue you're talking about, but back to the issue of tax compliance on HSAs, and I admit that that doesn't necessarily solve that, but that's a different day than an HSA design for people where it is making a difference. Representative Venmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pree, just following up on those questions, because... my understanding is these are two separate issues, whether someone might qualify for medical assistance and whether an HSA account might be available to them are completely unrelated. As a self-employed person who runs a small office and has a moderate-sized family, I think it costs me...
standards.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry. No, it's moderate compared to some Finns that live out by us. I think it cost me, for just my family last year, over $12,000 for insurance. And that doesn't even begin to cover what it cost me as an employer to offer to employees. Just so I'm clear, because I think Representative Otremba might have confused me, which is not too difficult, this is a choice, right? I mean, I, as an employer, can make an election if HSAs are available that might make sense for my family, might make sense for me to save premium, but I can also offer as an employer to my employees an option to choose, right?
Yeah, there is. And you really, from an employer, a small employer, you have to look at the economics if it makes sense to have both of those options, but there is the ability to do that. And really what we're looking at it is from the standpoint of you're trading premium dollars for dollars that can go into a savings account. And so basically you're taking that trade-off of whether you're going to have the expense or not have the expense. And again, if you have the expense, you're no worse off than you are today.
If I can follow up.
Just so I'm clear, though, just, Mr. Preby. If I can sort of inject my own thinking, although you can... My hunch is, based on people that I've talked to in the market, is it would be very unlikely you would as an employer. Right. Most likely you would say the smartest thing to do with the collaboration with your employees is decide one or the other.
Right. But just so I'm clear, you don't have to force this on anybody, right?
Right. No, you don't.
Thank you. That's what I want to know.
Thank you. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To follow up on what Representative Walker was talking about, one thing that we haven't talked about here much today is that not only is the consumer walking into a market and taking their dollars and shopping, but also the providers are also being pulled into a market. Mm-hmm. And then when markets start, you know, and they have to react to the market as well. That's why I think once we, and I think this will probably happen, once we create a critical mass of people on these programs, healthcare costs should start coming down just because of market effects. So I think there's a great potential here for savings. One specific question for Mr. Peavy. you've been talking about trading premium dollars for the savings accounts and the ability to jack up your deductible as you go to save on premium costs, and that would be an advantage for the insurance companies, I understand. But what if you want to back off? What do you need to do? You
have to be re-rated? Is there a guarantee issue that you can do that, or are you going to be stuck at one deductible once you get there? Mr. Preeby?
Well, no, in the state of Minnesota, if you're an employer under 50 lives, there's guarantee issues. So you can pick and choose that plan. Obviously, the premium may increase if you go back down to a lower deductible plan. You also, if you have an HSA account, you have to follow federal statutory guidelines around what's an eligible high deductible health plan to have that HSA account. So you've got to be careful that you don't all of a sudden cross the line and you don't qualify in that high deductible health plan anymore. So once you establish it, you gotta be careful that you don't cross the line and no longer become eligible to have that HSA account because your health plan, your corresponding health plan, doesn't meet the requirements.
I want to be sure we get done. I don't mean to cut off discussion, but I think I've got Representative Goodwin and Huntley. You wanted to have another shot, short one. And O'Trumbe, did you want to get back on again? Okay. And there was an Deacon also? Whew. Okay, I hope we can make them brief because we do have some people that wanted to testify. I want to be sure we get a chance to hear that. So let's try to be as brief as we can. Our question. Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that once a person retires, they can use this account for medical expenses. What happens to if they have a big account by then and their health care, they don't use the funds for health care? What happens to those funds? And I have a follow-up question to that, too.
Again, if they're over 65 and they have a large account established, they can use them for eligible expenses or premiums. They can also take those out and they'd be taxed as income over 65. So it's another vehicle. I've actually talked to a lot of 401k financial-type people who have suggested that individuals actually trade dollars off and reduce their 401k elections and put money back into an HSA account because from a tax saving standpoint, it goes in tax-free, comes out tax-free, unlike the 401k. So when you talk to financial people who really understand the financial models of it, they're actually suggesting people establish these because of what we talked about with the Fidelity study right now, that if a couple were to retire at age 65 in 2004, they'd have $175,000 in out-of-pocket medical expenses right now. What's that going to be in 15 years or 20 years? That's an awful lot of money to be dipping out of a 401k account that you might have established that you're planning for retirement to pay for medical expenses. So this is another tool to help you through the years to save up money when you get to retirement age to pay for out-of-pocket medical expenses.
But in worst case, if they didn't use it for health, they could withdraw it for anything and just pay regular income tax.
Over 65.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's going to prevent all employers from offering this and not offering a better health care plan with more coverage? How? Why wouldn't, you know, are people going to end up with a lot less health care coverage than they have right now, which is declining by the year, but basic services aren't being covered already in a lot of insurance plans. What's going to prevent employers from all going to this and not offering better coverage for their employees?
Mr. Kirby?
Again, this would be a personal opinion, but as you watch through what has taken place with health care used to be high deductible plans. Before we got into the managed care era of go see your doctor for $10 and encouraging you every time you had a cough or a sniffle to go to the doctor for $10. I think the concept was good. I think it's run its course, and people are getting back to the fact that why we buy insurance. We buy health insurance much like we buy car insurance and insurance for our homes and those type of things is we want to buy affordable insurance, but we want to be covered for that catastrophic event if it ever occurs. And so what you see is employers are starting to figure this out and that they can no longer absorb these high increases. Part of the reason is because we don't have a market in healthcare. We have, and especially in Minnesota, we have carriers who basically dictate reimbursement rates back to providers. Providers are stuck into that model, and we're not creating any type of consumerism or market. And I think the comment was made, when we create a market, inherently, it's going to change the cost structure. Providers who provide better service and who are good at the things they do are going to flush out, and people are going to want to see them, and they're going to people are going to make choices to pay more or pay less for that provider. And we're going to create a market which hopefully should reduce costs in the long run, much like everything else in our society does. And employers are also starting to figure out that through incentives and through these designs that as people start to take care of themselves and make decisions and reduce risk factors, and we talk about diabetes or high blood pressure or high cholesterol and those type of things, and build in plans and wellness ideas around people managing risk factors, that eventually healthcare costs are going to go down. When underwriters underwrite health plans, they understand based on a population and the demographics there's going to be a certain number of cancers and a certain number of heart attacks, and they build that into premium. What they can't predict is how many times everyone's just going to go to the doctor randomly at $120 or $130 for every cough and sniffle that someone might have and not making wise decisions as a consumer. And then also comes into the technology of healthcare. So I think that employers are going to, as you see what's happening in the marketplace, more and more of these offerings are going to become available. I also think that employers are going to start offering more wellness education around how people can take care of themselves and make decisions around using these dollars.
In my sense, something good one is that a lot of really good employers want to be able to offer benefits to their employees. And frankly, I mean, the cost that people are seeing individually is being seen and many times borne even more heavily by employers. So employers are really highly motivated to try to find techniques that will help the marketplace hold down healthcare costs so they can continue to offer. I mean, I think the risk, if we're not successful in hold down, is to the contrary. I mean, the employers will drop insurance period, or they will continue to go to the high, very high deductible, which I don't personally think is the way we can go. I mean, for the very reasons that Representative Trump is mentioning, it gets to be just out of sight in terms of affordability. I hope that this is one of the powerful tools, not the only, but a powerful tool in terms of trying to get the market to be a little more realistic in holding down increases. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Preeby, the high deductible plans are still subject to all the regulations we have for small business, like guarantee issue, like rate bans, so there's really no difference in that.
Mr. Preeby?
You're correct.
I don't think the record was doing real good on your head shake.
I have it.
Thank you. Representative Otemba.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I might have missed this. After age 65, how many dollars can you have in your health savings account?
Mr. Preeby.
You can have an unlimited number of dollars. And if you have an account beneficiary, and if you were to pass away, that account beneficiary would then those dollars would move to your account beneficiary. So you don't lose them. A mutual fund company don't get them. It stays with a beneficiary, just like a 401k or life insurance policy.
So, Mr. Chair, under 65, is it only the amount that you have as a deductible? Is it always unlimited?
It's always unlimited based on your contributions and the growth and what types of options you choose. We're working with an HSA provider right now who has a model between spender and saver, so they're letting people choose. So if you have a chronic user of the plan, they might choose the spender option, where their funds are going to go into more of a mutual fund type thing, more liquid movement. If you have people who don't use the plan and want to go more into a saving model, they're going to go into that, and it's going to look and feel like a 401k type selection through their employer form, and it's going to go into the stocks, and they're going to have choices to put those dollars, but those dollars can grow to whatever amount over the course of time.
Well, the only difference at age 65 is just what happens on a distribution, taking money out. Otherwise, the accumulation is the same.
And then one more question for Representative Wilkin. Can you tell me what this costs as far as tax loss in Minnesota?
Representative Wilkin?
I have that somewhere here. Mr. Rue handed it to me right before.
Well, I know that in prior year it was about $3.2 million in the first year, and more. And it's somewhere in the $7 to $8 million, I think, over the biennium is what I understand, which really is a matter for the tax committee, but that's as I recall the number.
Yeah, and I think there's some, like I said in my earlier testimony, that there's a competitiveness issue here, and that you could make an argument that could be offset if we don't use this to keep the cost of doing business low here in Minnesota and provide our employers and our employees an opportunity to save money through this mechanism.
Thank you.
Mr. Nikon, last shot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question goes to the issue of cost, if this is going to be very effective in holding down or reducing the cost for health care generally. It seems to me that when you're encouraging people to take on greater risk with a higher deductible, isn't there the risk that people may wait until their illness becomes a catastrophic illness, which in which case it's going to cost more to treat? It seems to me that there could be significant cost savings in prevention, getting people in early before it turns into a catastrophic illness. Will this result in more people waiting until an illness becomes catastrophic before going in?
Mr. Fudy?
No, because what is done at the federal level is they've allowed preventative care to fall outside of the deductible levels at 100%. So you actually can purchase plans that cover preventative care, well baby care, those type of things at 100% outside your deductible. So you don't have to use your health savings account. It doesn't go against your deductible, and those services are provided at 100%. So these type of models, if put in place right, actually encourage people to seek preventative care, take maintenance drugs, those type of things, and those dollars don't run against the deductible or out of their savings accounts.
Mr. Chairman,
question real quick.
That real quick too. There was a RAND study done some years ago. There was like a massive study, and I don't have the exact citation for you, but it measured consumer behavior basically in these kind of situations. And what they found is that consumers get the needed health care. What they don't do is the extra going in for the sniffles or the stuff that we're trying to prevent the utilization on, but for the stuff that they really need, which I think is your concern, they still get the health care.
And I think the experience, I believe the plan that was designed, the HRA plan by Olmsted Medical Center, they did not have, I think, that preventive medicine thing that you're talking about. I don't think so anyway. And they're seeing that people do make smart choices. They're not that foolish. They might, instead of going in for an earache, call the nurse line, which is smart shopping.
Right.
But otherwise, they do take care of themselves, even in terms of prevention. Well, I think we've had a great discussion. I know there are a number of people that want to testify, and I would just ask, keep in mind the discussion. So if you want to just come forward and say, I like it, that's fine, too.
Sure.
Do you have some time, Mr. Fudy?
Can I make one just last comment?
Sure.
Being in this industry, in this business, in the state of Minnesota, and just so you know, HSAs are here. They're in the market. People want them. They're seeking them out. They're looking for them. Let's not make it difficult for people to have these type of plan designs in the state. And it's all levels. Again, it's home health care workers who are low-wage workers, medium-wage workers, the high-income workers. These plan designs are in the marketplace. They're available to Minnesotans right now. They're purchasing them every single day. And if we don't conform to the federal tax law, it's going to become really confusing for employees that have these plans when it comes tax time for them. They're going to be very confused, and it's going to actually probably maybe discourage folks to actually continue because it's going to be so confusing at tax time for them. So I really encourage you to move forward.
Well, thank you. I think it helps shape the issue more clearly. We've had some discussion. There may be different opinions about HSAs, but the reality is HSAs are here. We're not going to change that reality.
Thank you.
Okay. I have on my list, first of all, Karen Jones.
That's pretty much exactly.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Carolyn Jones. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Chamber. Since it's my first opportunity before this committee this year, the Minnesota Chamber does represent about 2,800 businesses, small, medium, and large, statewide. I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of both of these bills this morning. As you know, it is a perennial issue for the Minnesota Chamber about trying to do what we can to address rising health care costs and access to health care. We did a survey this summer, actually a statewide business survey. Most of our surveys tend to be of our membership, but this was a statewide business survey. And in that survey, we found that about 16% of Minnesota employers were considering dropping coverage. And I found that percent rather alarming. I think in previous surveys we've seen that at about the 8% level. So this really is almost a doubling of what I have seen before, and I I found that very alarming. And I think that HSAs, again, while not the answer to all of health care, really can provide a tool that might help address some of those needs if in case those employers do follow up on that concern. maybe just to try and touch on a few things that haven't been said. We have seen a great interest in the HSA issue. A public opinion strategy survey found that more than 7 in 10 Americans with private health insurance had a favorable opinion of HSAs. And that really was across the board. And some of the things that they cited that they liked about HSAs was the personal control that they got out of it, the choice, and the lower costs that have been indicated. On the uninsured, I think some people have touched on that. Just again, I think some of the studies that we've seen, if you look at them across the board, that 30% range seems to be what we've seen on overall. There is a study by Assurant that actually had that at a 43% rate, that 43% of the plans that they had sold were to the uninsured. I also recently saw a survey just of employers who were purchasing HSAs, and that was at about 10%. So 10% of employers who were purchasing previously did not offer coverage. So I do think that this will be an effective long-term tool that we can have for the uninsured. A couple of myths that we talked about, I think, today, that HSAs are only for healthy individuals. Some studies that we have seen show that 77% of HSAs are actually purchased by families with children. Another 70% are purchased by people who are over 40 years old. I think some University of Minnesota research has shown that it, for at least people choosing the HSAs, that there's really not differences in terms of demographics of who within a certain setting is choosing that. So, in other words, we are not seeing kind of that early evidence of the adverse selection that that has been raised concerns of. In response to Representative Eakin's concerns, there was a study by Assurant that actually found, as I think Mr. Peavy sort of alluded to, but it found that preventive office care visits were up 31% under HSA programs. So again, I think most plans are taking advantage of the federal laws on that and are including preventative coverage in their HSAs, and we are seeing that actually increases in preventative office visits. Also on the issue of the wealthy, I think data from e-health insurance shows that almost half of people who are purchasing HSAs actually make less than $50,000 a year. I think the tax component of this I probably won't go into too much, but I think the real benefit of this, we had high deductible plans around previously, and the tax treatment didn't work. If we take half of that advantage away for Minnesotans, I think that will be a real disservice in terms of being able to take advantage of the state portion of that tax saving. One just issue on the retroactive treatment and the timing of that. Not many people know, but there is a Department of Revenue, Minnesota Department of Revenue ruling that has stated that because we weren't in conformity with federal law, that they are interpreting the rollover of an MSA, which is the previous form of the HSA, to the HSA, that is taxable income. So anyone who previously had an MSA and is now rolling that over into an HSA, if they had $20,000 in that account, that will be treated currently this year as taxable income. So I think the timing of trying to get the retroactivity and to move to this will is very important and will have some implications. And then just briefly to your point, Mr. Chairman, I think really to have the full impact on overall health care costs that HSAs can have, we really need to accompany that with information. And I know this committee has been very interested, and I know the work that you have done, but I think the more we can do to move to make sure that individuals and consumers have full information about the cost and the quality of health care so they can begin making these market decisions is very important. And I applaud you for the steps you've taken in that area and hope that we can continue to go down that avenue.
Thank you. Question, didn't you have a question? You want to this witness? Or?
I did, and maybe either you, Mr. Chair, or the witness. And I understand that the cost to the tax considerations in this are about $3 million. I don't know if that's right or not, but I'd ask if that's correct.
Yeah, we had a question about that before. We think that the biennial cost would be probably somewhere between $7 and $8 million.
Okay, and then I guess my question either to you or to our witness from the chamber is, where is that money going to come from?
Well, Representative Goodman, I think as it's true for the billions that we're spending, the task committee will have targets. I think as a lot of us feel like that's a minuscule investment for a very important cost containment rule opportunity that we have, but they'll have to deal with that just like we all do. I don't think anybody can say exactly where it comes from at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Abel?
Kind of to that same point then, Ms. Jones, the 2,800 businesses belong to your group. How many, what percent offer insurance now, do you know?
Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I think if you look at Minnesota statewide, it's generally in the 67%. We're very high in terms of employer coverage. Amongst our members, I would say our members are a little more enlightened than the average, and I think our rate of insurance is around 78%.
And Mr. Representative, just to kind of follow up, and do you think that this HSA, the whole, whether we comply or not, the whole array of HSA options is going to make it easier for that 22% to offer some kind of insurance? And do you think there would be a move to enable them to get more on, even be more on
money? Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, yes, I do. I think some of the early statistics that we have seen, as I mentioned, the 10% that of employers who previously hadn't offered coverage, I think we will see movement from employers who've never offered it, and also for those who are considering dropping to make sure that that does not occur.
Just check the point of the funding. Thank you. And I think to the point of Representative Goodwin about the cost, I personally think that part of the increased cost in the public market is due to the erosion of the private market. If we can find ways to stem the tide, in the aggregate, the fiscal note of a global nature would show that this will actually reduce pressures on our overall budget and give people better.
I'm inclined to agree with you. Reality probably is we're not going to probably get a fiscal note that reflects because there's kind of a delayed time frame, but I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. Thank you for your testimony. Just as a comment to that, I can tell you if you look very carefully at the forecast update that we just had, I think the DHS people would tell you we've already seen the impact of the reverse of that. That is, we've already seen from the erosion of the private market the spillage into our public assistance programs. So if we can stem the tide, if you will, and reverse that, very critical. Now, I don't think anybody presumes that this is going to be the panacea. I think we all admit that. But to the extent that we can beef up that private market, the better off we are. So next is Wayne Nelson. Mr. Nelson, if you can help us, we need to move along and work this out. We've got a lot of information in front of us before. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Wayne Nelson. I serve as president of Communicating for Agriculture and the Self-Employed. We're a national nonprofit association headquartered here in Minnesota with tens of thousands of farmer and small business members in almost every state, including over 1,000 members here in the state of Minnesota. I've been a long-time advocate of consumer-driven health care, and we feel that through the health care consumer, our members and others around the country, of taking control of their own health care dollars, we can all be better off in terms of lowering the cost of insurance and trying to educate these people as to some of the ways that they could do this, and certainly health savings accounts are one way to do this. I just want to point out my own example, I guess, of some figures of what with my own insurance policy. First, the policy I had before was a $1,500 deductible traditional plan, a PPO traditional plan, that cost $599.49 a month. And moving that to a $5,000 deductible, single deductible, federally eligible for a health savings account, the premium is $319.15. And that is really one of the big keys is by increasing the deductible, that there is definitely premium savings, and I think that's what is driving a lot of this. Then I contribute to monthly to an HSA account, and again, as others have said earlier, I can decide whether or not to take money out of that account to spend on the first dollar insurance costs or not. And as you said a couple times during this hearing, Mr. Chairman, this is not a panacea. Certainly, it is one way. Maybe there's a dozen ways to help nationally to lower that number, 43 million uninsured. But this is not the only way, but it's certainly one way that we think is very important to be able to do this. We feel that these plans will help more farmers and small business people to keep their health insurance coverage, even though they, as costs are going up 12% this year, they go up, a couple years ago they went up double-digit inflation with health care costs, so you have the people that can keep the coverage of this. And additionally, I would concur with the other groups that say that about 30% or closer to one-third of all of these plans sold now are to uninsured people. So you are keeping people insured that are presently insured that might run the risk of losing it, and then you're also helping to insure the people that haven't had insurance before, at least for some time. We feel it's very important that states, including Minnesota, take steps to provide similar tax incentives that the federal government has. There are 31 states that have that now, and we feel it's very important that Minnesota would join in offering this compliance with the federal deduction. We offer an endorsed health plan, as many associations do, in to all our members throughout the different states, and over 80% of the sales of those health plans are in federally eligible high deductible health plans. So we support HF 9 and 135 and urge your approval. Thank you very much.
Your wonderful testimony. It was excellent. No questions? Thank you. Beth Hardwick? Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Beth Hartwig. I represent Minnesota Business Partnership. I'll keep it short.
Thank you.
The Minnesota Business Partnership supports HSAs. We don't think it's the full answer, but it is one tool in the toolbox. And I would just echo everything that the testifiers before me have said.
Ms. Hartwig, just a quick one. You have companies that are actually exercising and offering HSA products. Any kind of sense of how much that activity?
You know, I'm not sure if our member companies are actually offering HSAs, but I know that some companies are looking at consumer-driven plans. So I don't have an answer for how many might be offering. I can certainly.
Jim Huntley.
Well, she sort of answered my question, but it'd be nice in a couple of years if the big companies are offering two types of plans. Is there segmentation of
absolutely
into?
I'd sort of ask as it is happening. I think any feedback you could give, because that is a very serious question. And I think Mr. Peeby kind of addressed it, and I don't know if we're yet quite figured out the cost points to avoid some of that potential adverse selection.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we do survey our members regularly, and I think I'll probably add questions along this line to that.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify regarding this? Please come forward. On your face, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, and I would also ask you please recognize the time that we have available for the committee here and help us out.
right, yes. Twilight Bay Citizens Council on Healthcare, and we have long supported health savings accounts and indeed had a presentation in November with someone from the U.S. Department of Treasury to come and talk about them. I show you overheads. It occurs to me that perhaps there isn't availability for overheads here, but I have three overheads that I typically show when I give presentations to just give people a better idea of the advantages of health savings accounts. One of them is actually an article from the Investors Business Daily, which showed that a study in 19 1989, which has been reported in 1994, found that of 1 million employees in self-insured companies, that one-third of them had no health expenditures at all, 73% of them had $500 or less in health expenditures, and 89% of them had $2,000 or less in health expenditures. So there is a general fear that a lot of people actually have problems and will have catastrophic conditions, but it's not really true. Most people actually don't. And then what I was going to say...
Well, Ms. Race, if you'd like to, you could get copies of those to our staff, and we could distribute them. I don't think we're going to be able to read it from here anyway, so we'd be happy to distribute to the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll do that, but you can see here, at least in the part that I've circled, and it's in an article by Merrill Matthews called It's the Saving Stupid. So that's one. This one you won't be able to read either, but it but I can tell.
Got that right.
But it came out of an MSA coalition 2 months before the HSA law was passed, and it shows the savings at that point at the deductible that they were considering, and you can see, okay, so you can see how many years, oh, they do have that.
I think that's in the packets.
That's great. And then here's what was discussed. There we go. Here's what was discussed about who bought HSAs. And so the first one, which you can see is previously insured and previously uninsured, and this is out of Assurance Health data. And the next one is having to do with income and college levels, giving you just a picture view of some of what has already been shared. How do we turn this off? Okay. And so the only, I have a cautionary tale, I guess, to put into this, as I heard what Representative Huntley said, about the concern about how your HSA would be used and whether or not it would go through into what the health plan decides to pay. And one of the reasons why we have supported a health savings account is because we look not toward a future where employers continue to be the sponsor of health insurance, but where individuals actually own their own policy and true market economics come into play, where actual individuals will come to you and say, you know, we don't want all those mandated health benefits. We don't want you to require all this because we're looking for a real affordable policy. And that's not going to happen at the employer level. And so I have my caution is that we don't look at this as a way of getting employers more embedded into insurance, and that we don't look at it as a way of continuing to force the HSA through the insurance, because that just continues the paperwork and the bureaucracy and such. And so when you're considering that with Representative Huntley's concern, our concern is that we really want to have the HSA looked at as cash. We want the negotiation to start beginning, and we want people to start seeing that there is a different way of doing healthcare and negotiating and not continuing to pull it all through the insurance company where it's very expensive. So that's, but we do support the idea of getting people to start looking at it and acting at it as their own money. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Seeing no one, and there being no further discussion, Representative Wilkin renews his motion that House File 9 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. You understand that motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. And members, if I may, Representative Wilkin move also House File 135, similar, well, exactly the same. And just in deference to remembering the chair of our Ways and Means Committee. And we move the House File 135, Representative Wilkin moves that House File 135 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Commerce Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Do I understand that?
I need a roll call vote on that.
I'd be happy if you really want one. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion. motion prevails.
Representative Wilkin, thank you. I think it was a very informative session today, and this is an issue that is evolving, and I think a lot of us learning. Tomorrow, I believe, we're going to be starting a review of the budgets in the Health Department with us tomorrow, and next Tuesday, we'll have the Department of Human Services. It would be my intention that we largely focus on understanding it. We'll have plenty of time for debate, but mostly those sessions will be getting a clear understanding of what each of those agencies are proposing. No further discussion, we're adjourned.